Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is John O'Brien introducing Dr. Henry Bowman on Halloween, 30th of October in San Francisco, towards the end of the North American Spine Society meeting. Henry, thank you very much for spending this time and effort and sitting down and letting us interview you on your life and times. You weren't born in San Francisco, were you?
No, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland.
What year?
1937.
Vintage year. One out of the own heart. And tell me, were you you were born into a medical family?
My father actually was one of the first 10 orthopedic residents at Johns Hopkins, and originally carried out the first hip replacement, metal replacement, and did a number of other research endeavors while he was at Hopkins and a Shriners Fellow.
Were you the only child of the family?
No, I have a brother that's 2 years older, but he did not go into medicine. So I initially had no interest in going into medicine, much less orthopedics. But that came along later after spending a summer with my father, traveling around and seeing his clinic.
He was the first Bowman in the medical line, was he?
Yes.
Before we go in, are you happy with that, Frank? That says record?
It's fine. Okay. The sound is okay, right?
The sound is fine.
Okay, that's fine.
So you were already as a kid, you were born into a... you went to school in Baltimore?
Initially went to grade school in Baltimore, and then we... bought a farm down near Annapolis, Maryland, which we still have actually. Same farm. 56 acre place that we grew up on and actually truck farmed it. And my brother and I and two other Scottish boys lived on the place. And there was a farmer, tenant farmer, that kept us in control and worked us for 10 cents an hour. So we grew up with more of a Germanic work ethic, I think. And from that standpoint, I went to school in the local area, which was a school called Severn, which was a preparatory school for the Naval Academy, which I had no intention of going to, but it was 2 miles from the farm, and that's where I started my early education.
Did you have any inkling, in those days, did you have any pressure applied from your father to do medicine? Did you ever consider it? Or?
No pressure whatsoever. He downplayed that, actually. I think it was more initially, to be honest, growing up on the farm where we raised all of the animals and milk cows and sheep and hogs, and we killed all of our own meat and processed that, and I became interested in biology and animal life, and I think that had a major influence on my deciding to go into medicine later on, but I think it was other people that influenced me too.
Now tell me, America entered the war when you would have been 4 or 5.
Yes.
Second War. Do you have any recollection of the time in the Second War? Was there any deprivation or rationing at all? Or was your father at war?
My father was, I believe, still in the Air National Guard Reserves. What I do remember, not rationing, but actually his concern was that there would be rationing, and was one of the reasons we had this farm and raised all of our own meat and vegetables. But I remember distinctly air raids and the sirens when I was a little kid in Baltimore and the lights going out and fear of being attacked. By German subs.
What was the closest? The mainland was never bombed or invaded.
No.
Not at all. Not like Australia, which actually had a hit from the Japanese at Darwin.
No. No.
But there was always a fear of it. It was a very serious fear.
Air raids.
I don't think people realized that.
Oh, air raids, and they built air shelters. Air raid shelters. So it was some fear growing up, but yeah. That was short-lived.
Were any kids evacuated from the, say, the coastal, the seaboard inland because of the fear of airbags, which happened in Australia?
No, that never happened.
No. So, what year did you go to high school, Henry?
I started high school in 1950, approximately.
In Baltimore?
Well, it was in the, we were near the Annapolis area. When I started high school, the Severn School, so it was around 1950. Then I finished there, approximately 55.
Did you have any idea then that you wished to go into medicine?
Still had no thought of going into medicine at that time. No real interest in orthopedics, although I saw my father doing his thing, working pretty hard. And he had started in Baltimore and then moved down to Annapolis where he had a farm.
Can I just cut there for 1 second?
Cool.
Are you ready?
Yeah, we're on.
Okay, so you finished at high school and you were still very open-minded about what you were going to pursue.
I really had no real thought about going into medicine at that time. And I was very interested in athletics. That was a major academic interest, or a major interest with my school.
Which sports?
At that time, I was playing football, American football, and lacrosse, the old Indian game, and wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up doing wrestling to get in shape for lacrosse and went to the state meets. Doing that sport, but went on in college to continue to play lacrosse and wrestle. But then at that time, I think I was deciding on a scientific endeavor. And early college, I would say, I thought about going into pre-medicine curriculum, which they had at our university, which was Washington Lee University.
In Baltimore.
Now, Washington Lee is in Lexington, Virginia. It's a little further south. And they had a scientific general curriculum in the first year and then 3 years of more science courses and electives.
Looking back now, do you think the early time on the farm gave you some interest in your in the grape and the vine?
We actually raised...
Did you grow any vine?
Yes, we did. Actually, we made our own wine, which at that time I didn't realize would become a passion later on. But we raised grapes, and I made wine. We made different types of wine, as well as killing all of our meat and raising all of our vegetables and truck farming. My father was very busy in his orthopedic practice and had moved out of Baltimore down to the Annapolis area, but was going to the eastern shore of Maryland at that time. But it was really a good life because we were it's on the water near the Chesapeake Bay Basin, and the seafood was unbelievably plentiful, and we fished and did oysters and crabs and of course raised all of our own meat and grew up in a very healthy way on the farm.
It would be a unique lifestyle by today's standards, wouldn't it? It would be impossible to live that way.
Oh, almost impossible. Mm-hmm. But I think what it did for me in my career is get me involved in living things, plant life, mm-hmm. animal life. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of half raised by a farmer and his wife who didn't have any kids. And I think they sort of instilled a work ethic also, and just learning to do things, to build things on the farm and improvise, I think, is probably did influence me more later on in my surgical world, finding yourself in the operating room in a difficult technical situation.
That's a fascinating background because it's very, very similar to my old chief professor, Hodson, who had that same almost agricultural background, which helped him enormously in later his later profession. So tell me, what medical school did you attend, Henry?
At the University of Maryland Medical School in Baltimore, after I finished Washington and Lee. So I spent 4 years there. And at that time, I did a summer sabbatical with my father, but before that, did one in a cardiopulmonary lab, but decided I wasn't interested in that type of medicine. And I became more interested in surgery. Still at that time, had not thought about going into orthopedics, but I was interested in surgery because I wanted to do things with my hands and felt comfortable with that. And in that era, we finished medical school and did an internship and then a whole year of general surgery before we went into our specialty training, which I think was a great background for learning your technical expertise. And I purposely, I finished medical school in 1964, stayed on at the University Hospital in Baltimore, and purposely took a mixed medical pediatrics internship, knowing I was going into surgery. Then did an entire year of general surgery, where they farmed us out to the eastern shore of Maryland, to a small hospital there, as well as some other places, but predominantly at the University Hospital.
Was your father a contemporary of Robbie Robinson?
He,
or colleague at all?
Yes, Dr. Robinson was the chair of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery when my father was on the staff there. Prior to that, the chairman was Johnson, but I grew up, even as a teenager, visiting Johns Hopkins with my dad, making rounds periodically and seeing some of his patients, and Dr. Robinson was the professor and chairman at that time.
And he was for a long period, wasn't he?
Yes, I'm not sure, probably for 25 years.
Yes.
Not sure the exact number of years, but he also was a major innovator in orthopedic surgery, not only in spine surgery, but in electron microscopy of bone and cartilage, and was the first one to study that. Very academically oriented, but fabulous clinician.
After you finished medical school in 1964, you interned and then did a residency program. Where was that?
I finished my 1 year of general surgery residency at University Hospital of Maryland, and then with Johns Hopkins Hospital for my formal orthopedic training. And there were, at that time, there were 4 residents a year, and we actually signed a contract that after the first year, one person would be assigned to the lab as a research person, but the residency was 3 years, excluding a year of research, unless you did that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in Baltimore, obviously, too. So I started there in 1966.
With an interest in spine, or by this stage, you in general surgery, or
I had no specific interest in spine at that time. But it was.
But you were keen to become a surgeon.
I had already done a year of general surgery, and I decided to go into orthopedics. Actually, having spent a summer with my father prior to that, so then I was accepted at Johns Hopkins and started my first year of orthopedics in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So it was
a 4 year residency, a 4 year training program?
With the year of general surgery.
Yes.
Whether it be there or somewhere else.
Yes. And who were the main influences on your life at that stage?
I'm sure Dr. Robinson was a major influence. I actually saw my father doing some very innovative things that were almost heresy at that time. And he was a big believer in immediate internal fixation for fractures and immediate mobilization of the joints. And this was absolute heresy in my residency, where we strung everybody up in balance suspension and watched them for months and while they got their stiff knees. And but he was a very innovative person. But Dr. Robinson was a major intellectual influence as well as a role model for many of us, certainly myself.
Did he encourage many from your generation to do orthopedics and spinal work?
Well, then I think it was his interest in spine and the anterior approach to the spine, much the same as Hodgson at that time.
So they were quite good friends, actually.
Yes. I think that was a major influence. But the real occurrence that changed my life was Dr. Robinson calling me into his office one day and sitting me down after the first year, and he said, like, Henry, I think I want you to go into the lab. And at that moment I froze in my seat, became apoplectic, and thought, the world is all over. I'm going to apply to another program, you know. So I went back, I talked to my father. I said, you know, I'm not an academician, I'm not a researcher. Dr. Robinson wants me to go to the lab. I said, he'd show me all these pictures of calcium transport and electron microscopy of bone, and I tried to tell him I was not the academician he thought I was. And so my father said, you're crazy, this is the best opportunity you could have in your life. And so I thought about that. I knew I'd signed the contract, and to this day I think it's because I was the only bachelor in the residency that I was banished to the lab. But what happened was, after about 2 weeks of ruminating over all this and deciding that I was going to have to do it and accepting this, they had another project, which was the beginning of a large National Institutes of Health grant to study head and neck trauma. And the first year of this 4 or 5 year grant, which was combined with neurosurgery, was to do a pathology study of fatal head and neck injuries. And that was a turning point in my career as far as an interest in spine.
This was an epidemiological study, or it was a pathology study?
This was a pathology study, and it took place...
Autopsy study.
It was an autopsy study that took place at the Baltimore City Morgue, now called the Central Anatomic Laboratory. But they received all the folks that were killed in vehicular trauma or any pedestrian trauma. Mm. And so another young neurosurgeon named Don Davis came from University of Pennsylvania, and we were both put on this project. And essentially what we did was take the year, and each day we went down to the morgue and we looked to see what folks were killed in vehicular accidents or trauma. And we developed a protocol to study these people pathologically and radiologically. And what we did was a very detailed radiologic study in which we did all kinds of flexion extension x-rays of the neck. We actually did hanging views as sort of a traction view on these cadavers. We then started the autopsy, or they started the autopsy, and removed the central organs, then the brain. Then we did a vertebral artery angiography study with a special solution that we cooked up that was radiopaque. Then we went through all of the series of x-rays again, which turned out to be about 19 x-rays on each patient, to study the vascular system in conjunction with the cervical trauma. And then we took out the cervical spines and spinal cords in toto from the posterior approach.
Most of these people had head and neck injuries, I presume.
They had visible head trauma. Mm. And that was one of the major objects to understand, the association of head and neck trauma, and how common was it together.
How was this information used in the design of carved seats or backrests or...
Well,
was there any spin-off in Practical Use?
Well, the first... there were many spin-offs to this, not only to my own career, but to orthopedics and neurosurgery. What we found was a very high association of head and neck trauma. And nobody had really put that together, that when people come into emergency rooms, when you see visible head injuries, you have to look for a neck injury. And that was early on in the trauma world. In addition, we saw a number of the brain contusions associated with neck cervical trauma. And they later in the those clinical years, this was 1967, 68, started intracranial monitoring at that institution, which was the first one to do it. But more than that, this eventually was published in the lead article in the Journal of Neurosurgery in May of 1971. I at that time didn't realize how important this was. I was fairly naive. What it did for me was realize that there was a combination of pathology in the cervical spine, and they were not usually, they were not isolated ligamentous injuries or isolated fractures necessarily. And the other thing that registered in my head was that of the burst fractures or wedge compression fractures, all of these people had bone compression of the anterior spinal cord. Mm. And I'd grown up in an era where the patients were treated with cervical laminectomies inappropriately, where it did not decompress the anterior pathology, was compressing the cord. So that made no horse sense to me whatsoever.
So the cervical laminectomy was still quite a common procedure in the early 70s.
Very common procedure, even at Johns Hopkins, you know, supposedly a state-of-the-art institution. But after that year, I had conceptualized the anterior approach based on that pathology study and based on Dr. Robinson's already well-known anterior approach for other cervical spine diseases. And then when I went back into my residency, I kept seeing laminectomies being done for these neck injuries in patients that were incompletely paralyzed, would wake up with complete quadriplegia. So I was positive this was the wrong way to approach it and made up my mind I was going to stamp this operation out.
Is there still much of it, cervical laminectomy and neck trauma?
It's fairly unusual. Mm. Only in patients rarely that have no fractures that I think predominantly neurosurgeons might think that laminectomy is the way to go when it's just cervical spondylosis rather than fractures, but I think for the most part it still is a bad operation.
So when did you finish your orthopedic residency, having done this research year?
Well, I finished up in 1970, but another key thing occurred to me in my senior year of residency, which led me on into my career that turned out to be the subspecialty of spine surgery. At that time, I was very interested in spine and spinal cord injuries, and I had as a senior resident, I had a young 16-year-old high school student admitted to the hospital having done gymnastics and flipped on his back and sustaining a flexion injury with a compression fracture C4. And he entered the hospital as a incomplete quadriparetic, but almost motor complete. He only had a flicker of toe, big toe on one side. And we watched him as we did in those days, put him in a halo cast and watched him for about at least 2 months in the hospital. And finally, based on my pathology year, we saw this compression fracture, did a myelogram, saw anterior cord compression. So I decided to do an anterior approach that I knew how to do anyhow. Take out the vertebral body, decompress the spinal cord, and do an anterior fusion. Mm-hmm. And we carried that out in this fellow, actually with the neurosurgical colleagues, We were working together pretty closely. And much to my surprise, the next day I came around on rounds and this kid was flapping his feet and regaining fairly rapid motor recovery. So that, to me, was a major influence in what I thought.
Which year was that now?
That was 1970, my senior year of my residency. So I knew deep down inside that this just was not circumstance, that this couldn't have happened that rapidly. So it was at that time that I was intensely interested in spinal cord injuries and began thinking about academic orthopedics and knew I was on to something really important. So I finished 1970 and had an obligation to the Air Force because I was in a reserve program that kept me out of Vietnam.
It was the Vietnam time, of course, wasn't it? You didn't go to Vietnam, but you were close?
No, this program called the Bering Plan kept us out of being drafted going to Vietnam so we could finish our specialty training. But then we had a two-year payback. So at that point, I wound up in Sacramento, California, Mather Air Force Base, which ironically was Dr. Robinson's base in the Second World War when he was in the Air Force. So I went there.
You were still in close contact. He was a mentor and friend.
Oh, very much so. Yes. At that time, he was starting to invite me for instructional course lectures at our academy and talk about spinal cord injuries. And it was then the evolution of this anterior approach that I was talking about in the pathology study. So while I was in the Air Force, I had more time at that point, and I continued my interest in the cervical spine injuries and began a very large study of 300 cervical spine injuries. And I would fly back to Baltimore periodically for two-week periods and pull out 50 charts at a time and all the old x-rays, and that's when I started this major study of 300 cervical spine injuries, which took about 6 years to rewrite the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. Then eventually also became a lead article in the journal, I think was a...
What were the conclusions in that important work?
Well, there were a number of conclusions. The first surprise that of the 300 cervical spine injuries, 100 were missed or not diagnosed in the emergency room situation, mainly because of associated head injuries, alcoholic intoxication, polytrauma, other distracting injuries. So that was a big surprise to everybody. But then again, this was published and reported to emergency room physicians and orthopedists and neurosurgeons to be aware of this phenomenon. The other major area was the fact that taking for 30 years all of these injuries and the operative versus non-operative approach, many of these patients had laminectomies, and approximately, I think with probably 30% of the patients with incomplete cord injuries became complete after the laminectomy. So we sort of pronounced that this was a bad operation and was contraindicated for cervical spine injuries. On the other hand, the anterior decompression approach was very beneficial and very safe and gained the most neurologic recovery of any operative treatment. Another analysis that we did, which was not prospective, and in this stage of acute steroid treatment, we found in this retrospective study that the incomplete cord injuries treated with steroids actually did worse than the patients treated without steroids. And there was a 12% incidence of fatal GI hemorrhage with steroids, which was...
But what effect did the steroids have on the cord?
It had the cord recovery. The steroid group was less than the non-steroid group.
Why should that be?
I'm not sure, but I still don't believe that steroids have a major impact on motor recovery.
I suppose it remains controversial, does it?
I think it still is. In this country, unfortunately, it's a legal the legal thing that people are feel mandated to give the steroids. But when you really look at the data that's published, the improved motor recovery is very slight. Mm. And in one group, in the original Bracken study, the one group of motor complete, sensory incomplete, actually did better with the placebo.
Mm.
So I'm not convinced that this has any major innovation.
But no. So where did you move on from there, Henry?
So after my 2 years in the Air Force, I knew I was interested in academics, so I was looking, and I was interested in the anterior decompressions for spinal cord injuries in some center where they had a number, a large volume of spinal cord injuries where I could go. And
they could, I mean, thinking back, I was in Hong Kong at that time, but you must have, there must have only been a few people thinking along that line in the States at that time.
Oh, there was nobody.
In Rancho, perhaps, with Perry, or they weren't seeing the acute work.
Well, they were seeing the acute, they were seeing the acute patients, but nobody was really going anterior decompression for spinal cord injuries. And it was a very new concept. So there were, my mission was twofold. One was to stamp out laminectomies, which of course were being done mostly by the neurosurgeons. And secondly, to try and prove that the anterior decompressions and stabilizations resulted in better neurologic recovery and were safer. So I searched around for academic centers, and at that time Dr. Robinson had retired, and Dr. Lee Riley was the chairman at Hopkins, and suggested to me that Case Western Reserve was probably one of the up-and-coming academic centers. It was the professor there was in Cleveland.
Yeah.
University Hospital associated with the Case Western Reserve Medical School. Dr. Charles Herndon was the chairman then, a very dynamic individual who ultimately became president of our academy and was the first person to even propose continuing medical education in the United States. But he and a fellow named Victor Frankl recruited me to Cleveland, and there they had at that time an 80-bed spinal cord injury unit at the Veterans Administration Medical Center. And when I went to interview, I saw all of these patients laying around in bed being treated conservatively or having had laminectomies, and I thought, this is somewhere where I can begin to do my thing and hopefully do some research. And
were your seniors approving of your concept of anterior decompression? It was a novelty to them, I suppose.
It was very novel. I think they probably looked with some questioning. The interesting thing was that the neurosurgeons who were not doing it either at that time became very upset that we started doing this type of surgery because they really had not done this before. And in fact, talked against it as if it were some experimental operation, which basically it was not. But I started a research lab at that time with VA money support, some orthopedic education research foundation support, and my interest was to study mechanical factors causing impairment of recovery from spinal cord injuries. For instance, simulating bone fragment compression of the injured spinal cord in dogs, and we at that time created a pressure transducer inserted in the anterior cervical spine, created incompletely quadriparetic, some quadriplegic dogs, which today would be very difficult to do with the animal rhesus. But we created this animal model, ultimately published that a couple of ways in results of late anterior decompression, which proved to be beneficial. At the same time, we were beginning to first watch the spinal cord injured patients to wait until they plateaued from their neurologic recovery, because I didn't want to be accused of operating too soon and doing something that would have occurred naturally in the natural recovery. And what we began to see, because we were waiting an average of 12 to 13 months to do the cervical decompression. We would see these patients recover to a certain extent and then plateau neurologically. Then we would do our anterior decompression, and over, I would see, sometimes within days, fairly rapid recovery of motor function. And again, at that time, for years, nobody was really doing this. And I'm sure people didn't believe us when we were presenting this on national forums. But we began seeing very significant neurologic recovery.
And your work has certainly, through your efforts and the efforts of the residents you've trained, it's had a profound impact, as you well know. Just tell me, I'd just like a few words from you on your training that you've done over the years, and training in general of spinal surgeons. Do you think it's important for orthopedic and neurosurgical people to be working together in spinal surgery?
Well, I think it's, for training purposes and educational purposes, I think that's the ideal situation. Have your educational program, your spine conferences, and your surgical endeavors, both your problems as well as your successes, talked about in a combined way, and I think that's the ideal situation. I think we have that at University Hospital now. I think it's extremely important in this day and age of both traumatic as well as reconstructive spinal surgery, which has become very complex, that either neurosurgeons or orthopedists should have an additional year of specialty training. I do not think, even in a good training program such as ours, that the resident getting through that should be going out doing complex spine surgery. And I think the same is true of a neurosurgical training program. I think the age in which orthopedists and neurosurgeons thought they could do any spine procedure after their general training is over. I think this is wrong, and there should be spine fellowships for both orthopedists and neurosurgeons.
Do you think a full-time spinal surgeon is here to stay?
Oh, without any question. Yeah.
What do you feel about this new board for spinal surgery? Do you approve of that, or do you feel it's complicating the matter?
I think it's complicating the situation. I think the first thing that ought to be done is to standardize the spine fellowship training program, because I think they're very diverse. Some are very good, some are very poor, and some only do lumbar, and don't do cervical, and some don't do trauma. I think that's probably the most critical thing to accomplish first with this diversity of spinal training. But I am totally convinced that spine fellowships, good spine fellowships associated with an academic training program, are extremely important for the spine surgeon of today and the future. Historically, we've had a spine fellowship training program since 1973. And today, we take three domestic fellows a year, and there are always some foreign fellows, usually Japanese, Thai fellows. We have a fellow from Brazil that's just there for a short period of time. But the domestic fellows get experience with over 300 complex reconstructive and trauma spine cases a year. So when they get through that year, whether they've done research or not, they're quite capable of doing almost anything in the spine that's out there. And I think this is extremely important for training centers to have fellows like this.
What about a center for spinal surgery, a full-time professor of spinal surgery? Do you think that's challenging the neurosurgeons and the orthopedists too much?
Well, I think what we have created, I'm almost that myself in this day and age, but what we have created at the University Hospital Complex is a spine institute that encompasses all the subspecialties that take care of the spine surgery patients, the neurosurgeons that do predominantly spine surgery, all the orthopedists that are, we have full-time spine surgeons in orthopedics, both pediatric deformity as well as adult reconstructive. We have our patients all on one floor, which happens to be the neuroscience floor, so that the nurses know how to take care of spine patients, and it's a very specially oriented area. is very important for quality of care. I think in our country, the length of stay of complex spine surgery patients in the hospital is shortened tremendously, really cut hospital costs, and it's quite safe. And we have a combined effort to control quality of care between neurosurgery and orthopedics, and the nursing care becomes standardized.
Sure. Just a couple of questions, specific questions, but I'd like your personal views on them before I ask you about your great hobby of wine tasting and collecting. Are you a great believer in the cage that you used for interbody fusion at the moment?
I'm not convinced this is the way to fly yet. We have done a few at our center. I think I want to be open-minded, but I think there should be very specific uses. I think the ideal use is for the single-level adult discitis, degenerative disc disease in a non-workman's compensation, well-motivated person that has chronic back pain. I think that's the ideal situation. I am not...
Do you think they heal?
I'm not sure. I think it's very difficult to tell.
We don't know yet.
I don't think we know yet, but I personally think they're being overused and abused at the moment for poor indications. Mm. I would be very concerned using these in instability situations like ischemic spondylolisthesis at L4-5.
Let me just ask you another thing briefly. The pedicle screw crisis has come and gone.
Yes.
Are you relieved of that? Because I know you do a great deal of failed back surgery.
Yeah, I think, ironically, I got into the pedicle screw business myself, again, watching to see how all of this would work out, and I think it has sifted out from a big surge of using this in everybody, because we know the fusion rate is higher, but I think it's come back down to where I think we have been thinking over the years that there are very specific indications for it. We have worried about the medical legal situation, but that's never been a problem in our personal institution. But I think it's been a great innovation as spine surgery for the proper indications, but I am certain you don't need it for everybody, and I think we have very specific indications, but because we've heard now that even though the fusion rate is 95%, it doesn't mean the clinical outcome is going to be the best.
And I'm not sure, actually, that the fusion rate, I mean, what is the fusion rate of 95%? It's not great masses of bone growing through the cage, and that message I go away with from this meeting is that the idea of bone sort of pouring through the cage and linking the two vertebral bodies is not a common thing after a couple of years.
I'm, from my own horse sense standpoint, I'm very skeptical that those small fenestrations in a number of these cages are going to be adequate to have solid bony union. It almost makes more sense to use the allograft dowel,
yes,
with autograft bone, to me, I mean, from a biologic standpoint.
Sure, sure.
But again, I think it's the indication for using the procedure in the back pain patient.
Let me ask you this, Henry. What do you think is your biggest contribution to spinal surgery?
I think...
Maybe your spinal cord study.
I think my biggest contribution has been the anterior approach for spinal cord injuries, which is now published from a standpoint of cervical, thoracic, and lumbar, where the neurologic recovery is far superior than any other operative procedure. And now I jokingly say we've put ourselves out of business because the whole world is doing it, but I think it's put to rest the laminectomies for the most part, and so has instrumentation in the lower spine. And I think it's shown everybody that the neurologic recovery is so much better. The ambulatory patients are much more prevalent, but also as more recently, the anterior approach has been parlayed into other reconstructive surgery. And as you know, we just published a lead article in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery on probably the largest series of cervical myelopathy from spondylosis in 108 patients with anterior decompression and fusion with 2 to 17 year follow-up. And when you look at the neurologic recovery in that group of patients, I think it's far superior to laminectomy, laminoplasty, and other types of anterior decompression.
Look, this has gone very quickly, but it's left me a few minutes at the end to raise with you your very special expert interest and knowledge in wine and its collection. I was interested earlier in the interview, you mentioned that your farm gave you an interest in all these various matters, including you were growing the grape and making wine. You've become something of an American authority on this. Would you like to tell me where this began and where it's going?
I don't know whether I'm an American authority, but I should mention before, as I talk about the wine interest, I think another thing I'm very proud of in my career is the impact that we've had in training spine fellows for academic institutions, because we don't take these fellows unless they're sworn on the great Bible to go into full-time academic orthopedics. Mm-hmm. And I think the impact that's had has been enormous, and I think I'm very proud of that too, mm-hmm. because I think that's, they're out there training other individuals.
That's the most important thing, is
surgery.
To be able to hand the message down along
yes.
the line, isn't it?
But I also train them in the world of enology and mm-hmm. my special passion and hobby. And I think I developed an interest in wine and food when I was a bachelor going through my training, and I was entertaining a few young ladies at that time, and we had all the meat from the farm and vegetables and whatnot. And I started buying wine and tasting and reading about wine at that time. But I couldn't afford to collect any at that point. And finally, as I went to California in the Air Force mm-hmm. and lived near the wine country of Napa Valley and had a little more money to put away wine, I started collecting and more over the years have become involved in a local wine group in Cleveland that's 25 years old mm-hmm. and the Commanderie of Bordeaux, which is a French organization with chapters in the United States. This has become a passion and a mm-hmm. hobby and a love. And I think at this point, having collected about 7,000 bottles, I realize I'm not immortal. And I'm going to have to pass it on to my son, who fortunately has developed an interest in a palate.
Right.
But I think it's a fabulous hobby because you can go all over the world and you meet friends that are interested in wine and different
Absolutely.
Types of wine. And it's so much fun to drink it with
which
friends.
Which is your special interest area? Is it the Californian wines?
Oh, everything. I collect French Bordeaux, both white and red Bordeaux.
Australian?
I have green Hermitage going back to the 70s, 60s, through into the 90s. Spanish wine, a little bit of Spanish wine, Vega Sicilia, but I collect great French Burgundies, both the white and the Monachets and the Grand Cru, reds and whites. Rhones, red Rhones, white Rhones, ports. Being a stalwart Englishman, I know you love Bordeaux and ports.
I was called Australian.
Originally Australian.
Originally Australian, Sydney boy, yes.
I thought originally London. But, anyhow, having visited Australia a few years ago, toured Penfold, where they make the great Grain Hermitage, which is one of the greatest red wines in the world, and that's just been a wonderful hobby. I collect Californias also, the good ones, and Sauternes. I have the great Chateau Yquem, which was collected by George Washington Thomas Jefferson, our presidents. I have that back from 1966. And all
but
the
this must
years.
Be this must be one of the great American collections of wine.
Well, I don't know. I don't think there's anything in Cleveland to match this. There's one person in Ohio that has a great collection, but I think it's
it's up there with the best, I'm sure. Look, I'm sorry our time has run out, but I just want to thank you enormously. This has been very very educational, and it's been marvelous talking to you, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, John.
All right, that was perfect.